I next met with Dr. Eric Weiner, and to begin, we discussed perhaps the area of greatest recent interest in breast oncology, the management of patients with metastatic HER2-positive disease, an arena suddenly made more complex, first with the approval of pertuzumab in June 2012, and then the very recent approval of trastuzumab emtansine, T-DM1. And Dr. Weiner began by commenting on a concern he has in terms of clinical use of this fascinating antibody-drug conjugate.
My fear is that people will start without a lot of thought combining it with other agents because it is an agent that by itself has such little toxicity. But we don't have any data that combining it with another agent is better than giving T-DM1 alone. And that kind of work really needs to be left to clinical trials. There are phase 1 trials going on now looking at combinations, and that's something that will probably be explored in the adjuvant setting. But at the moment, when T-DM1 is used, T-DM1 should be used by itself.
So it would seem that certainly the one agent that people might want to think about combining it with, because it's a pretty natural thought, is pertuzumab. What are your thoughts about that, and where is the MARIANNE trial that's going to give us the answer?
Yeah, I think that is a fairly natural thought. The phase 1 work with the combination has been completed, and the MARIANNE trial is going on, and the MARIANNE trial is comparing a taxane trastuzumab versus T-DM1 alone versus T-DM1 plus pertuzumab. And that study is set up to both compare T-DM1 with standard chemotherapy and trastuzumab, and also to look at this very important question of whether pertuzumab adds to T-DM1. I think on the surface, you'd say it probably should add. If it adds to taxane and trastuzumab, why shouldn't it add to T-DM1? But I think we're going to have to see.
When do you think we'll know?
My understanding is that MARIANNE is going to report out, I think, sometime in late 2014. You know, because it's a first-line study, it takes a long time to get the requisite number of events to be able to answer the question.
So in terms of, again, kind of thinking about how you might utilize it, I guess one thing, you know, people always kind of say, well, you know, you bring up the issue of older people or people who really are poor candidates for chemo, and people always say, well, you can give a little bit of paclitaxel, it's really not that bad. But I mean, there are people you don't even want to give paclitaxel to. And I mean, could you envision, you know, wanting to give T-DM1 to somebody who's never had trastuzumab?
I certainly could. And I think that in the metastatic setting, there will be selected patients for whom you wouldn't want to give trastuzumab alone, which is a regimen that I very rarely use, where you might want to avoid the chemotherapy and give T-DM1. In truth, I'd like to avoid the chemotherapy in everybody, but I think, you know, you're really getting at that patient where it's almost wrong to give chemotherapy because she's just not going to tolerate the therapy. And I think at the moment, we're going to have to ask for permission from an insurer to do that. But I think that for most patients, they'll probably still get chemotherapy first, and presumably they'll get, if they, you know, have not previously seen pertuzumab in, for example, the adjuvant setting, I think that in the metastatic setting, the first-line regimen for a patient who's presenting with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer at the moment will be a taxane and trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and the second-line regimen will probably be T-DM1.
And what about retreatment with T-DM1? Do we know anything about that? You know, even the idea that maybe somebody gets treated, they have a response, you know, probably, I guess you're going to continue it until progression, then you go on something else and progress. What about coming back to T-DM1?
I don't think we know anything about it. In fact, I know we know nothing about it. I think it's a reasonable question. I do think that it's the presumption that when a patient develops progression on T-DM1, the T-DM1, at least at that point in time, will be stopped. And if one wants to continue anti-HER2 therapy, which most people will want to do, that they'll substitute in trastuzumab again.
I guess another issue, given the relative lack of toxicity with T-DM1, would be the idea of combining it with chemo, but without a lot more data, it doesn't seem like it would make a whole lot of sense.
I don't think it does. And the other thing is, you know, we don't have phase one data for those combinations. We do now with the taxanes, but we don't with any other agent. And the taxanes aren't probably agents that most people would want to use in that setting.
You mentioned pertuzumab, and I just want to sort of get an update from you on where things are in terms of any new research data on that, and also what's going on clinically in terms of what you're combining it with.
And so we are feeling pretty restricted there by insurers, and we're using pertuzumab pretty much according to the label. We're using it in the first-line setting with either docetaxel, and we feel fine doing it with paclitaxel. It has a compendium listing, and it's a recommended regimen by the NCCN. So in that first-line setting, we either use docetaxel or more commonly weekly paclitaxel with trastuzumab and pertuzumab. We have, in a handful of cases, asked permission from insurers to give pertuzumab to patients who have had multiple prior regimens or one or two prior regimens and who have not had the opportunity to receive pertuzumab in the first-line setting, and we've been able to get approval. And in that situation, if the patient hasn't had a taxane, we'd give it with a taxane. We don't have a lot of experience giving it with other drugs. There's a study, the so-called VELVET study, that's looking at pertuzumab and trastuzumab in combination with vinorelbine. I think that's a pretty natural study given the fact that vinorelbine and trastuzumab are given commonly, and I think one presumes that it's going to be well tolerated. But the result of all of this is that we don't have that much experience giving pertuzumab in patients with metastatic breast cancer because at any given moment, in any given day, week, month, there simply aren't that many patients presenting with newly diagnosed metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer.
Any situations where you might consider pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting? We know that it adds, at least in terms of the Neosphere study, but clinically, is there any time you might want to use it like that?
So I probably wouldn't. You know, I think that the neoadjuvant results are really interesting. I think that's true with both lapatinib and trastuzumab and with pertuzumab and trastuzumab. But we don't know that they are going to translate into long-term benefits. I think we really need the adjuvant studies to help us there. Or we need neoadjuvant studies that are larger that are going to give us long-term follow-up. And so I actually don't make changes in practice based on response in the breast. And the other issue is that one of the main reasons outside of a study that one gives neoadjuvant therapy is to allow a woman who would otherwise need a mastectomy to be able to undergo conservative surgery. And my recollection is that the rates of conservative surgery do not differ by arms in those studies.
Although, I mean, clearly the response rate was greater. You know, the other thing too, I don't know if this would ever come up, but again, getting back to the patient who really you don't want to give chemo to, I mean, they did see some responses there with just pertuzumab and trastuzumab alone.
So I think that's, in fact, one of the most impressive results. And overall, if I remember right, in the Neosphere study, 17% of patients who were randomized to trastuzumab and pertuzumab alone, no chemotherapy,
had
a path CR with 12 weeks of therapy. And if you subdivided and you looked at the patients with ER-negative HER2-positive disease, it was something like 27%. So I think a critical research question is looking at whether there's a subgroup of patients who have such a high path CR rate to these biologic agents alone that you are then comfortable not giving subsequent chemotherapy to and following. And they're hard studies to do because it involves peeling back a lot of therapy. But they're the kinds of studies we're going to have to do to be able to get to a point where we can say that a given woman can do well with biologic therapy alone.
And at San Antonio, again, we saw a bunch of studies trying to figure that out. And I know there was one Edith Perez presented. There was stuff you were involved with. I haven't seen anything that looks all that promising to pick out people who are going to respond to anti-HER therapy. Have you?
You know, it's really pretty disappointing. So, you know, virtually all of the efforts to look at this in the adjuvant setting, Edith and others have looked in great detail at the PI3 kinase pathway and various components and have failed to show that trastuzumab either works or doesn't work based on any molecular predictor. Luca Gianni looked at essentially an immune signature and suggested that that might be predictive of better response, but clearly that needs further work. I think, you know, one of the interesting findings is from Cleopatra suggesting that alterations in the PI3 kinase pathway do not affect the benefits of pertuzumab, but across the board decrease the benefits of whatever HER2 regimen is being used. And that begs the question as to whether that could be overcome with a PI3 kinase inhibitor.
So you mentioned immune parameters, and I've got to ask you whether or not you see breast cancer ever jumping on the anti-PD-1 or checkpoint bandwagon, having just spent this past weekend with Julie Bramer and a bunch of other people looking at some pretty exciting things in lung cancer. Anything possible in terms of breast cancer?
I think the answer is breast cancer is jumping on that bandwagon. And, you know, this is entirely anecdotal, but we've known for years that there are patients who do much better than others. We don't think that it's all about the tumor. We've always assumed it's something about the host or the host-tumor interaction. The whole study of immune-based therapies and immune predictors in breast cancer has really been in its infancy. But these agents look like they're really important. And I think that it's going to be really critical to study drugs like PD-1 and PD-L1 in patients with breast cancer.
I was telling somebody that when Julie was speaking this weekend, I have never been in a room that was quieter. It was almost like freeze. People weren't even breathing or moving. It was just really fascinating. Do we know whether or not breast cancer expresses the PD-L1 ligand?
So it does some of the time. And there are studies going on that are looking at that. And in fact, in one of our studies, which is an expansion cohort of one of the phase 1 trials, patients have to actually have PD-L1 in their tumor in order to go on the trial.
So let's finish out in terms of metastatic HER2 positive disease. And your group, particularly Nancy Lin, has been very interested in the management of brain mets.
Brain mets becomes a bigger and bigger problem the longer patients with metastatic HER2 positive breast cancer live. I guess I think about brain mets as being divided into two groups. There are those that are probably present at the time the disease is initially diagnosed. So when a woman has stage 3 breast cancer, for example, and has undetected brain metastases, and those, my sense is, become clinically symptomatic pretty early on. And then there are all the other patients who at some point during the course of their illness have seeding of the CNS with the development of brain metastases. And it's probably somewhere in the range of 50% of all women who have metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer who experience some CNS disease at some point in time before their death. Now, you know, we used to think that about half of those patients ended up dying what I will call a CNS death, meaning that it was their brain metastases that was taking their life. My best sense, and I haven't seen any data on this recently, is that that's not as common and that a lot of these presentations of late brain metastases are easier to manage either with stereotactic radiosurgery or whole brain radiotherapy or a combination, and then the use of systemic drugs. So I think it's the minority of patients where the brain disease takes over, but I will tell you that in my own practice, just in the last year, I have had somewhere in the range of, I can think of 2 right off the bat, and there's another one as well. So somewhere in the range of 2 to 4 patients whose brain disease was the whole problem. Their systemic disease was a non-issue. Their brain disease was what it was all about.
We did a symposium in San Antonio. The first case was exactly that situation, somebody who was NED systemically, but, you know, essentially deteriorating because of brain mets. And you mentioned the 50% figure, and actually in your series here of 113 patients, it was 55% clinical brain mets in these patients with metastatic disease. Next thing I was going to ask you about was ATLAS and all that stuff, and kind of also gets me thinking a little bit about the long-term natural history in breast cancer and the unusual propensity for delayed relapse. Has there ever been much of a thought that in any way this could in any way be immune-related?
So I think that Exactly what goes on in terms of late relapses is a big question, and one of the possibilities is that it's related to immune function and, you know, somehow tied up in tumor dormancy, which can be related to immune function. And if it is, it may or may not be the case that simply adding on more hormonal therapy is the answer. Clearly, for some patients, extending the duration of hormonal therapy is an effective strategy, and I think that's really what ATLAS points to.
So I interviewed Richard Pito on this audio program, so rather than go back through all the details of ATLAS, I was just curious about your take in general and what you think it means in terms of current clinical decision-making.
I think that for the postmenopausal woman who has a uterus and has been on 5 years of tamoxifen, that I think it would be a pretty tough call knowing whether adding on 5 more years of tamoxifen makes sense or not. And that's where I would really pay very close attention to whether a woman is at high risk or low risk of recurrence. And of course, in most of those postmenopausal women who have had 5 years of tamoxifen, most of those women are women who started when they were premenopausal and received tamoxifen because they were premenopausal and are now postmenopausal. Most of those patients are probably better treated with 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, as was done in MA17, so you don't get into this risk of endometrial cancer, and where you know that an aromatase inhibitor after 5 years of tamoxifen is very effective therapy. I think the situation where we are most likely to use 10 years of tamoxifen will be in the young woman, the woman who is 32, 34, 38 when she presents, gets 5 years of tamoxifen, is still premenopausal. We have not a clue what to do with that woman, or we haven't until now. And now we know that we can continue tamoxifen for 5 more years. And in her, because she's still cycling, she has very little risk of endometrial cancer. And the result is we can continue tamoxifen and provide a benefit.
So just to be clear, though, in that patient who starts out premenopausal, they get to 5 years on tamoxifen, are you saying that your thought would be about switching to an AI at that point, if they were menopausal?
If the woman is menopausal, then by all means, I think that the best treatment is to switch her to an AI. And so I really think that there are two situations where you're going to think about 10 years of tamoxifen. Either in the young woman who's still cycling after 5 years of tamoxifen, where you're going to add it on, or in the 54-year-old woman, she was 49 when she presented. She went through menopause at 52. She's now 54. You put her on an aromatase inhibitor, and she just can't tolerate it. She has arthralgias, and she just doesn't feel good. And she says, you know, I've put up with this for 6 months. You've tried to manage this. I don't know what to do. Is there any other alternative? And that's where I think you have to have the discussion, weighing the risks and benefits of tamoxifen in that postmenopausal woman. And I have to say, I would be very much influenced in that decision by, number one, what her overall risk of a recurrence still is. If she's a woman who had multiple positive lymph nodes, I would have a different view than if she had a small node negative cancer. And I would also be influenced to some degree by whether or not she has a uterus.
I think there's another factor too, which is how do you actually determine whether the patient has really become menopausal? I know there are a lot of concerns that people might get switched to an AI and their ovaries might still be a little bit active. So it sounds like a simple question, but how do you deal with it in your own practice?
Yeah, so I was afraid you'd ask me that question. So in the woman who's had 5 years of tamoxifen who I'm putting on an AI, I'm usually a little less worried about being so certain, only because, at least until now, there hasn't been another great alternative. And I'm still not sure that tamoxifen for 5 more years is a great alternative. I think it's an alternative. And so if I'm wrong, I don't think that the consequences are so dire. Where I am more worried about that issue is in a woman where she's starting endocrine therapy, and we think she's postmenopausal, but she really isn't. And as a result of her not being postmenopausal, we're giving her essentially no endocrine therapy. But the truth is, you actually can figure this out. And for the woman who's been on 5 years of tamoxifen and has stopped cycling, one of the options is just to take her off tamoxifen, leave her be for some number of months, and reassess her menopausal status, both by finding out if she's been cycling, but also by testing FSH and estrogen levels, which once she is off tamoxifen for several months are accurate. And for the woman who's on an aromatase inhibitor, so you start this woman on an aromatase inhibitor, the truth is her estrogen levels should be very, very low. And if you find out that her estrogen levels are high, then I think you have some reason to believe that she's not postmenopausal.
So again, continuing along with the idea of ER-positive disease and trying to find new strategies, I'm curious where you are today in terms of mTOR inhibitors, specifically everolimus.
So based on the Bolero 2 results, I and we at our place use everolimus to some degree. We find it to be a relatively toxic drug. Most of our patients need to have a dose reduction on it. And in truth, because we've had a lot of studies with the combination of endocrine therapy and PI3 kinase inhibitors, we've probably put fewer patients on everolimus outside of a study than perhaps some people have. I think it's an option in patients who have AI, aromatase inhibitor refractory disease. Oftentimes the question is, do you do that or do you do a drug like fulvestrant? And I think that given the ease of administering fulvestrant, we usually give that. And then I think the other question is, from a quality of life standpoint, is someone better off taking an mTOR inhibitor or better off taking capecitabine, which is oftentimes the first-line chemotherapy there? I think most of the time we tend to stick with the endocrine therapy, but I still think that the real role of mTOR inhibitors in breast cancer is being defined. I think it's a nice option to have now, but I'm still trying to sort it out.
But, you know, it's interesting you bring up capecitabine because, you know, I kind of put capecitabine in the category of can be annoying, can be difficult, can require dose reduction, but usually doesn't have a, you know, terrible effect on quality of life. You can manage it with dose adjustments. Would you say overall that kind of is your perception of everolimus, or is it worse than that?
I actually think that if you manage capecitabine well, it can be a lot easier than everolimus. So, you know, you don't have to worry about the lung toxicity. Capecitabine is really a drug that I think is pretty easy to give. I do think that most of the time, given the choice between going on capecitabine, which patients view as kind and gentle chemotherapy, but still chemotherapy. So I think that many of my patients still want to hold off on chemotherapy and would opt for something like exemestane and everolimus. But I'm not sure in the end what's best. And the truth is that in this situation, most patients are going to get one and then the other or the reverse order. And I really tend to give them this choice.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was kind of flashing back when capecitabine first entered the scene. I think it was like around 2000, 2001. And I remember you were amongst the people that was very vocal about utilizing it. But it took a while for, you know, people to sort of embrace it.
Yeah. Look, it's a very good drug. I think many of us have the impression, it may not be an accurate impression, that it's that much more effective in patients who have estrogen receptor positive disease. And, you know, there are occasional patients, and part of this is that you can tolerate it for a long time, who are on it literally for years with a very, very prolonged response.
Yeah, I remember feeling really frustrated in the beginning because it was so underutilized, but I think things have really changed a lot. But that also brings up another paper from San Antonio I want to get your take on, which was there was a big phase 3 study looking at capecitabine and comparing it to eribulin. Curious what you thought about that paper.
Well, you know, I think that the hope on the part of some was that eribulin would be a better drug in this setting, and it just wasn't. And, you know, capecitabine did appear to be the winner in the comparison. It's also a somewhat easier drug to take. Doesn't mean that eribulin isn't a reasonable drug, and I think it is a reasonable drug to use in some patients, but I wouldn't use it as a substitute for capecitabine. And, you know, given the fact that eribulin more often than not causes significant alopecia and causes neuropathy and causes myelosuppression, I'm perfectly happy having capecitabine as the drug that works a little bit better there.
Yeah, just to clarify, though, because I did hear other people express disappointment that eribulin wasn't better, but we were just talking about how, you know, effective, relatively speaking, and less toxic capecitabine is.
I think that, you know, do I think that it matters whether you give eribulin first and then capecitabine, or capecitabine first and then eribulin from a survival standpoint? I don't think it makes any difference. And I think that this is a choice that doctors and patients can potentially make. But I personally would tend to stick with capecitabine. And I think there's reason for disappointment, which is that we know how good capecitabine is, so we'd like to have something that's even better, and then we still have capecitabine, rather than have something that is probably not quite as good.
Yeah, I can understand that. So there are a couple other papers that you are involved with I want to ask you about. But first, I kind of want to just swing through and touch a little bit in terms of adjuvant therapy. And going back to HER2-positive disease, I'm curious what's going on right now in terms of trials in the adjuvant setting with HER2-positive disease. You got pertuzumab around, you got T-DM1 around. What's going on in terms of new trials?
Well, there at the moment are not any that I know of NCI-sponsored trials. So we have essentially one trial going on. Well, there's the NCI-sponsored trial in HER2-negative patients or HER2-2-plus patients that the NSABP is doing. But in terms of standard HER2-positive disease, there's the AFFINITY study, which is randomizing patients to chemotherapy plus trastuzumab versus chemotherapy plus trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And there is a plan at foot that I've had some involvement in to do a T-DM1 study. Now, the T-DM1 study that's planned is a study that is very specifically for high-risk patients, because unlike what some people might have liked, it's not a study where there's an effort to get rid of some chemotherapy. It's a study where chemotherapy is being added to by T-DM1. So in that study, the plan is that patients will be randomized to chemotherapy plus trastuzumab and probably pertuzumab versus chemotherapy plus T-DM1 and chemotherapy plus T-DM1 and pertuzumab. And in truth, some of the decisions about pertuzumab, I think, have not been fully made. But one of the challenges with any study at this point is that patients with HER2-positive disease in the adjuvant setting do very well. They don't do as well as we want them to do, but they do well, and from a study design standpoint, it presents challenges. What we learned at San Antonio from the long-term presentations of N9831 and the NSABP trial is that only about 10 to 12% of patients who have node-positive breast cancer and received a trastuzumab-containing regimen have a distant recurrence at 10 years. That's a pretty small number. And so you're looking for improvements on that. And from a statistical standpoint, it becomes challenging.
So I got to say, I'm surprised to hear you say that the design is T-DM1 and chemo. When you said that, the first thing I flashed on was chemo, trastuzumab, maybe pertuzumab, followed by like T-DM1 maintenance or something.
Well, I didn't say that it was the study design that I personally favored.
Well, what do we know about, I was asking this before, what do we know about chemo and T-DM1, first of all, at all?
Yeah, so there has been a pilot of T-DM1 after an anthracycline that has been conducted where it was well tolerated. In that study, patients were also allowed to receive a taxane plus trastuzumab. So there is certainly information on the tolerability.
Now, this was simultaneously?
Not simultaneously. And it's not simultaneous. There is simultaneous data from phase 1 studies of both paclitaxel and of docetaxel with T-DM1. And I will tell you that my preferred design would have been a design where we began to get rid of some of the chemotherapy to reduce toxicity. And I think ultimately, one of the great advantages of a drug like T-DM1 is that we're going to be able to give adjuvant therapy without all the standard toxicities of adjuvant therapy. They want to look at a group of patients who are at very high risk, where they are concerned that doctors and patients will be worried about backing off on standard therapy, and where they're interested in seeing if they can take that 90% distant disease-free survival figure and bring it up. And we will see what happens with that.
So relevant to this issue of maybe giving T-DM1 instead of chemo and avoiding the toxicity, I had heard that you all were thinking of looking at lower risk, node negative kinds of patients in sort of a follow-up to your paclitaxel trastuzumab single-arm study to look at T-DM1 in the same situation.
We are doing that. So that is a study that we're very interested in. And so, as many people know, we conducted a large phase 2 trial, and phase 2 because we thought that we could never do a phase 3 trial, of paclitaxel and trastuzumab alone for 12 weeks, followed by the rest of a year of trastuzumab in 413 patients who have essentially stage 1 breast cancer. A few of the patients had T2 tumors, but that was less than 10%. The minority of the patients had T1A tumors. The vast majority of the patients had T1B and T1C tumors. If I remember correctly, about 50% of the patients in the study actually had T1C tumors. So these are not patients who have the tiniest of all cancers. And we now have about 3 years of median follow-up. We are hoping to present the data in San Antonio. The statistical design is set up such that we report out at 1,600 patient years of follow-up. At San Antonio, we're going to be at about 1,500 years of patient follow-up, and we think we can convince our DSMB to allow us to do that. In the meantime, we have designed, and we will be starting a study that's very similar with one big exception. So it is a randomized phase 2 trial that will compare, from a toxicity standpoint, T-DM1 and paclitaxel trastuzumab. And in terms of efficacy, we are using the same rules that we used in the paclitaxel trastuzumab study for the T-DM1 arm. So essentially, in that paclitaxel trastuzumab study, we said that we would consider a 5% recurrence at 3 years as an acceptable recurrence rate. Although in truth, given the recent data, I think we'd want to see less than that. And we are doing the same with the T-DM1 arm. So, you know, it will not be a definitive study, but it will be a study that provides a point estimate and gives us some sense as to how low the recurrence rate is for a group of patients with stage 1 breast cancer treated with T-DM1.
And you'll get your answers in less than 18 years.
Well, you know, I didn't say it, you said it, but if we tried to do a randomized study of paclitaxel trastuzumab versus T-DM1 in stage 1 breast cancer, we would probably have an answer long after I'm going to be dead and buried.
So, you know, getting back to the affinity study of, you know, chemo trastuzumab with or without pertuzumab, I've been given a lot of thought to this idea of when the best option for a patient is to participate in a clinical trial. It's kind of like a homily, we always say, but, you know, I think back to somebody who had HER2 positive disease, 3 positive nodes in 2004, and I'd say the best option for that patient was to be in one of these adjuvant trastuzumab trials. And, you know, kind of affinity sort of reminds me. I mean, maybe there's not as much ground to make up there, but I don't see that a patient has much to lose. It seems like you have nothing to do but gain by being on this study. Is that the way you see people, you know, looking at accrual?
So, you know, that's my view as well. I mean, what is there to lose? You're going to get chemotherapy and trastuzumab only anyway. And if you go in the study, you'll either get that or you'll get another drug that, as best we know, doesn't add a lot of toxicity. So why not? For reasons that we don't really understand, in the U.S., accrual has been fairly slow. And I think some of that relates to the fact that tumor blocks have to be sent off to Italy to confirm HER2 testing, and it's just logistically a little complicated. But I agree with you totally, and I think this is a study that should just accrue like gangbusters.
So another study that maybe you could make a similar argument with, maybe not quite as easily in terms of not much to lose, is the trial looking at everolimus in the adjuvant setting. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that. There, they're going to try to give everolimus for a year. You mentioned your concerns about toxicity with hormone therapy. How's that study looking from the point of view of accrual? And, you know, what do you think it's going to be like to try to put people on it?
Yeah. So I don't know how it's doing from accrual, but I actually think that study is a little different because I think that getting pertuzumab along with your trastuzumab isn't really very different. And I'm not sure that there's going to be any difference in quality of life between those two groups of patients. I'm not sure that it's being formally assessed, but I really don't think there will be. I think after you have finished a course of adjuvant chemotherapy, and in many cases, probably most, you've had a course of radiation, the choice between endocrine therapy alone and endocrine therapy plus everolimus isn't an insignificant choice. And I think that it's going to be hard to get all of those patients through a year of everolimus. I hope that it's possible, but it's a fair amount of toxicity, and unfortunately, it's for a full year, and that's tough.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how people do on it. You know, as a patient, I think it's certainly attractive to look at the possibility of reducing your risk of recurrence. I mean, we do help out, but there's still a long way to go, but I guess we can kind of see, you know, how people accept this.
There is one other thing with that study, which is that, you know, on some level, it's not fully keeping with what we know about everolimus. So we know that everolimus is a drug that works in patients who have AI refractory breast cancer. And so that's a study where patients who are starting their aromatase inhibitor with everolimus. Now, hopefully it'll work there. But I know that our European colleagues are actually conducting a study where they're looking at everolimus after a couple of years of an aromatase inhibitor. And in some ways, I can also understand how that study would have appeal. I totally understand why our colleagues in SWOG set up the study that they did, and, you know, hopefully it'll work. But it is taking a step beyond what we learned from Bolero 2.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, the other thing about that study I thought was kind of interesting that I'm not sure I've seen before was they integrate a recurrence score into eligibility. Can you talk about the thinking there? I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, well, so what they wanted to do was they wanted to identify a group of patients who were at sufficiently high risk of having a recurrence that two things. One, that they could justify randomizing to everolimus or not. And two, where they felt that there would be enough events that they'd be able to answer the question. And they did that in two ways. They did it by defining the tumor burden that a patient would have to have. And they did it in patients who didn't necessarily have that tumor burden by requiring a relatively high recurrence score that is associated, of course, with a higher risk of recurrence.
You wonder, too, whether or not, you know, an assay like the recurrence score or many of the others out there might in some sort of backhand way actually identify patients who might benefit from adding in a mTOR inhibitor. I mean, we know that, you know, in terms of high recurrence score tumors, not only are they more likely to recur, I guess more likely to benefit by chemo, but less hormone sensitive. Now, what that means, whether it has anything to do with, you know, mTOR inhibitors, I don't know. But you could imagine maybe some of these genomic factors might be helpful. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. And actually, I don't know that they're doing this. I suspect that they are. But I think it's going to be very important for them to get a recurrence score on a research basis on all the patients who enter the trial through the other mechanism, that is based on stage.
Right.
Because I think they're going to want to look across the entire study at recurrence score and its interaction with benefit from everolimus.